Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it.
Well, it's always a pleasure to host on our show not just individuals who are doing phenomenal things from the writing and media standpoint, but they're actually living their own life out to its fullest. So I welcome on the line Dr. Gordon Livingston of Maryland. How are you this morning, Gordon?
I'm fine, Zara. Nice to be here.
It's a real pleasure. Let me introduce to our audience. Gordon is a graduate of West Point who was awarded the Bronze Star for Valor in Vietnam. He's a psychiatrist and writer who contributes frequently to the Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle, the Baltimore Sun, so he's truly bicoastal there, and he lives and works in Columbia, Maryland. Gordon is a best-selling author of four books, Only Spring and Never Stop Dancing, the third, How to Love, and the fourth, Too Soon Old and Too Late Smart. His new book just released is The Thing You Think You Cannot Do, 30 Truths About Fear and Courage, and exposes the collection of human fears, meaning loss, intimacy, aging, inadequacy, and openly and honestly in the hope that people will choose to face them head on. And frankly, Gordon knows about facing fear and embracing courage in life, not just based on his career defending our country, but challenges in life, losing his two sons within 13 months of suicide and leukemia. So again, welcome to the show. Another book launch. You must have this down at my kind of like old hat. Is that true?
Well, it's they've been coming out every couple of years, right. And so I am sort of familiar with the process by now.
But everything changes, and I would expect, particularly with the advent of social media and the web and so on, it's got to be a new child every time for you.
Yeah, it is a little bit different now. It turns out that that a lot of people become aware of these things on Facebook and right. Twitter, and so I've had to kind of adapt.
Well, I think the other thing, Gordon, is you've got quite a following. So I'm certain you also get the, Gordon, what's the next book I'm waiting for you pressure to keep publishing?
I guess so. Although I think I'm running out of ideas. I sometimes feel as though I'm, that I've exhausted my supply, but you never know.
Well, and again, because you served our country, you've had your own life experiences under pressure that require, motivating others and being in a place of being in risk, but also demonstrating courage and valor and the like, but then also choosing the field of psychiatry to help other people cope with what's running around their head. Was that something that you always had envisioned becoming over time?
No, I actually thought I was going to go into surgery, but it turned out that I discovered during my training that I was more interested in ideas than I was in going in and out of the abdomen. So I decided that I was hearing some interesting stories from people, and I wanted to continue that.
Well, in the field of psychiatry, of course, talk about a change industry, right? I mean, the whole picture of the psychiatrist of the patient lying on the couch, sadly, I think sometimes this day and age, it's people more listening to the advertising and figuring what pill they should take as opposed to some of that deep journey that I suspect you really are committed to take your clients through.
Yeah, that's I've been fortunate in that I haven't had to, as a lot of psychiatrists have, rely on just dispensing medication. I'm much more interested in talking to people. So most of my practice is psychotherapy, although I do use medication at times.
Yeah. Well, you can't be running out of things to talk about, though, Gordon. If your new book here, The Thing You Think You Cannot Do, and then you tell us it's 30 truths about fear and courage. It's not 10. It's not 12. It's 30. So, and I know you've used that 30 number in one of your other books. So where does the 30 come from? Was that a grade age? Is that it?
No, it's just an arbitrary, it's an arbitrary number. When I sat down to write the first of this series of books, mm-hmm. Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart, I was undergoing kind of a career change from one medical group to another.
Oh, okay.
And I just was trying to figure out what I'd learned. And so I wrote down a bunch of aphorisms, and it turned out to come to about 30. I wrote an essay about each one, the things that I thought I'd learned over this long time talking to people, and so I've sort of stuck with that number, but there's nothing magic about it.
Well, see, so you could do volume two in the next 30, the next 60, right? So
yeah, there's,
you know,
always more things that are true, I suppose.
That's right. Well, see, I'm campaigning on behalf of your following here, that you're not slowing down, you're actually speeding up.
Yes, well,
let's talk about this new book for you. I mean, the thing you think you cannot do, just your choice of the title, that's apt to get anybody's attention, particularly when we know of the challenges you've gone through in your own life.
Yeah, well, it comes from a quote by Eleanor Roosevelt, mm-hmm. when she was talking about courage, and I like it because it points out that the only real antidote to courage, or at least the only real non-pharmacologic antidote, mm-hmm. to fear, that is courage. The facing things that we fear is the only way to overcome them. As she said, you must do the thing you think you cannot do.
Well, you know, I can recall I was a springboard diver in high school, and so you're always, you know, flipping and flopping and, you know, hit the water wrong every now and then. But I do recall right before a meet, I threw a dive practicing, and I pulled it too close, and I hit the diving board and hit this nice little red line across both of my legs. And, of course, the crowd gasps, all that nonsense. And I jumped out of the pool, and I turned right around, and I cut in line in front of my colleagues and said, I got to throw that dive again. Some told me that if I didn't do that, that one was going to fall right out of my list.
Yeah, well, it's a perfect example of facing, facing up as promptly as possible to those things that frighten us or that we've made mistakes on.
But the key was to see, I didn't realize how much I was bleeding or how much it really did hurt. But I just kept going. My question for you, who's an expert in this field, is that I have no idea where that came from that said, I got to get on that board, step away, I'm doing it again. But boy, in hindsight, I'm so grateful that I stood strong and didn't waver, despite the mess I left on the diving board there.
Yeah, and when we do therapy, of course, we see a lot of fearful people. I mean, mm-hmm. Fear was once an adaptive emotion when we lived on the African plains in the presence of animals that were much larger than we were. But now the things that we fear take the form of fears of rejection and humiliation and really, you know, fears of other people, social phobias and so on. And so I think but we still react to them with the same sort of fight or flight phenomenon. And a lot of people choose to flee, that is, to engage in avoidance behavior. And that, of course, makes the fear or anxiety worse. And whereas confronting it makes it better. It's just that it's a gradual process. It doesn't happen suddenly. You just have to, you do have to desensitize yourself to those things that frighten you. But if you avoid them, then your life shrinks. And one definition of mental health is freedom of choice and having freedom of choice. And if you lose that, then you in the worst case, you can become housebound. But but in any case, your life is restricted in some way.
Your years of working with people then to help them overcome their fears, I imagine your caseload, thus you just articulated, has changed a lot, that it's now coming and helping people deal with these social phobias. And you're right. I mean, even those of us that are parents of young children, the thought of letting our kids just go play in the neighborhood like we used to, I mean, we just have been reshaped.
Well, yeah, and this is an example of being frightened of the wrong thing, which is another aspect of the fears in modern life. I mean, we're afraid of things like shark attacks and child abductions, which are very very rare phenomenon, or terrorist attacks, also a very rare phenomenon, at least for Americans, and so we get preoccupied with these things, and we miss the real threats to our existence, which have to do with lifestyle choices and fastening our seatbelts and confronting climate change and those things that really do have an impact on our and will have an impact on our lives.
Yeah, and isn't that interesting? You point to some of the simplest things, fastening your seatbelt. you know, or making the right choice of what you're going to eat or what you're going to drink and when.
Not smoking. I mean, these are 20% of the population still smokes. So what's going on there? And so it's a, that represents a real problem that we kind of misidentify those things that we fear.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think your book, by the way, for our listeners, the book is The Thing You Think You Cannot Do, 30 Truths About Fear and Courage. And my guest is Dr. Gordon Livingston. Right there at the opening of your book, you really want to anchor, Gordon, this whole thought of that bravery. And that bravery is not just, the hero that might do the one act that really takes our breath away, but it's really more our habitual actions. It's the things we do time and time again that can build our resilience.
Well, that's right. And fear, of course, is an emotion. It's both a noun and a verb. Mm-hmm. But courage is an action. And so I think that's really important. And it's a derivative of the larger truth, which is that we are what we do. We're not what we think or how we feel or what we mm-hmm. intend. We're what we do. And so it's in these actions that we define ourselves as brave or not. And we're constantly, it seems, in search of heroes to model our behavior. Mm-hmm. But we choose. I think the term itself has gotten degraded, so that now everyone who puts on a uniform is a hero, or people who just perform competently. A surgeon, for example, who saves somebody's life becomes a hero when he really didn't take any risk. So I think to deserve that designation, you have to take a risk, you have to have a choice, and you have to do something on behalf of somebody else. I mean, a child who dials 911 and saves a parent is certainly has done a constructive act, but it's hardly heroic. So I think that we ought to be a little bit more cautious about who gets that designation.
Yeah, in fact, you make that point in discussing the loss of the shuttle astronauts that were killed.
Exactly. I mean, I think that the timing of that, of course, was significant. When the Columbia disintegrated, it was February of 2003, and just before we embarked on the war in Iraq. And the question I was raising in that particular piece was these astronauts were taking these risks in a humanly useful endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And did we really want to ask our precious young people to take the same sorts of risks in this upcoming war? And I think which I think turned out to be a colossal mistake. So I think that the objective here is to try to make heroes of those people who really do are acting in a way that benefits other people.
Now, this said by the man, by the way, who graduated from West Point and served in Vietnam. But I if I call my reading, though, it was after that time, though, that you really had to come to terms with yourself in terms of those whole decisions of the Vietnam conflict as well, didn't you?
I did, and I had to kind of face up to the fact that we were doing some pretty terrible things there, and that war was in which bears many similarities to the war in Iraq, was also rather a misbegotten enterprise, and to which I finally objected.
Yeah, I mentioned that your four other books, Only Spring, and then Never Stop Dancing, How to Love, and then the fourth, Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart. How is this fifth book now different or the same or a culmination or a shift? Is there a common thread through here,
well,
Gordon?
This book has a little bit more focus. I mean, I try to tell stories and introduce ideas here about what it means to live courageously. And I've got a number of examples in there of people who've been known to me who have acted in extremely brave ways when faced with overwhelming kinds of of threats, ranging from a young girl with a chronic illness who suffered for 14 years before dying at the age of 25, but who made something really important of her life and left behind a journal, which I quote from, my company mate at West Point, who died a prisoner of the Viet Cong in a very heroic and steadfast way. So that there are lots of these stories, and I think we can take inspiration from them. I just think that we tend to farm out heroism. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this way that people who have veterans of the of our wars, for example, are now being idealized. I think somehow there's a tinge of guilt in that. Mm-hmm. That we haven't ourselves sacrificed anything. We've chosen the small number of people, the small number of families, to do all the suffering for us, and it's not enough, I don't think, to say thank you for your service when 20% of the people who've served are coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Exactly, and in problems getting employed and reconnecting with their families and so on.
Yeah, I think we owe a debt to these people, and so it's not just enough to applaud them at airports.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Gordon, what was the thing you thought you couldn't do?
Well, there have been a number of them. I mean, the deaths of my sons, which you mentioned, was a kind of overwhelming sort of experience for me, and really made me examine whether it was worth going on with my own life after a loss like that, and whether I could ever do psychotherapy again in the face of that, whether I could ever take anyone else's problems seriously. And so that required a lot of self-examination, so that was I was an example of that. When I found out as an adult that I was adopted, for example, I had the choice of whether to go back and try to find my birth mother, wondering what would be at the end of that search. I had a number of people telling me that wasn't a good idea, and that I might not like what I found, and I might be rejected again. So those were the kinds of things that in my own life I felt as though I had to face up to, and that when I did, that the outcome was worth it.
That's fabulous. The journey to regain your confidence or maintain your courage or retap into it, continue a practice in psychotherapy, did that involve just taking some space and time away? I mean, you say reflection. What was a series of things you did then?
It wasn't long. I mean, my fellow doctors in my medical group gave me donated vacation time so I could take a couple of months to kind of, try and get myself together enough to begin seeing patients. But when I did, I realized something very important, and that is that whatever any of us is struggling with is very important, and that it doesn't do any good to assign a magnitude to one person's suffering over another. All of us need help, and in the giving of help to other people, we also heal ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so that was an important realization to me, and so I felt as though in some way, apart from taking care of the people I was still responsible for in my own family, that my work helped me through that.
Exactly.
Because it gave me a sense of continuing significance.
And has continued through many years since that time, too.
It has. I'm not able to quit. I'm working a little less now than I did, but I just get up each morning and think to myself, you know, I'm going to go in there and hear some really interesting stories, and so it's hard for me, as long as I can do the work, it's hard for me to imagine stopping.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's what I hear from you, is it's really not work. It's that constant quest for learning or knowledge or reconnecting or connecting other things for other people.
Yeah, connecting to those people, I think that's it, Zara. That's the sense of the kinds of things that we're talking about are Extremely important. These are really, they're important in terms of the ideas that they imply, but also the emotional connections that that are at stake, and the fact, and so that you know, it makes other things in the world, the kinds of things that we pay attention to, seem trivial.
Yeah.
Compared to the struggles that these brave people who I see day in and day out are coping with.
So tell me then, over the years, Gordon, how do you think you've changed by helping other people change?
Well, I think I've become more modest about my effect in my ability to change other people, and I've come to the conclusion that I'm there to listen, to provide some information, to be as empathetic and supportive as possible, but anybody who thinks that they're going to come to me and get a lot, get a set of instructions about how to live is that's misplaced. So I feel as though I've learned that the healing that goes on there is mostly self-generated.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
People discover within themselves these strengths that they didn't realize they had, and I feel honored just to be a spectator to that.
A spectator, an enabler, a director, a coach, that set the environment. Well, Dr. Gordon Livingston, this is a pleasure for us to get a chance to meet you. And Gordon's latest book is The Thing You Think You Cannot Do, 30 Truths About Fear and Courage. You can go to his website, gordonlivingston.com, and enjoy reading about actually all of his books, as well as there's some really great video captures and spots that you've been placed on. Gordon, so tell me, you're not going to slow down. I know that. Is the next book already bubbling up? I've heard many authors tell me that it was in the course of wrapping up the previous one that the next one, there's even the title head, in the last chapter, or when you go out on book tour and people start asking you, now, could you explain again what you mean by X? And then you realize, there's a possibility for me to go fill. Anything hit you yet?
It hasn't. I hope you're right and that something will, but I'm still waiting for that.
Well, life learning comes through our own struggles, for sure. But here you're a person that has allowed yourself to be open to being part of other people's struggles. And like you said, being modest, of course, of your ability to help change them rather from the inside out. But is there ever a time when you feel like you got to turn the noise off? Has it ever just become so overwhelming and a challenge for you to carry?
Well, yeah, but I think that was mostly when I was younger and in a sense working harder. There's that period of striving early in your career when you're taking on, in some cases, more than you can comfortably handle, and the job really feels like a job. Now that things have slowed down, I think that as we get older, one of the benefits is that we do fewer things that we don't want to do.
Yes.
And I've kind of reached that point. So right now, I feel as though I've got a pretty good balance with the writing and some speaking, and then seeing. But I'm still grounded in my work with patients. So
sure.
I'm feeling pretty comfortable at the moment.
So tell me, over your life, who have been your mentors and your role models and your heroes?
Well, there have been several. One of my early mentors was Jerry Frank, who when I had that problem with the Army over Vietnam, he was professor of psychiatry at Hopkins, and they very kindly took me into the program even after they had already filled their residency positions, and he was such a wonderful person. He wrote books on hope and books on nuclear disarmament.
Look at that, the impact today.
Yeah, and so I was just I've been very inspired by him, and there've been lots of people who I've made my patients have inspired me with their strength and other colleagues have contributed their ideas, and so these books, I feel that they contain very little that is original with me. You know, some of the ideas are borrowed and are circulating around in my head that I wouldn't know who to attribute them to.
That's the wisdom you can offer us and the enabling. Well, again, Dr. Gordon Livingston, the thing you think you cannot do. Again, for our listeners, GordonLivingston.com. We wish you the very best, and I'll look forward to featuring you for your sixth book when it comes out.
Thank you so much.
Have a great weekend. Thank you.
You bet.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.